This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! Hello, it's Tuesday the 21st of January. It's Holly Hamilton here in for Stephen this week on The Nolan Show. And today we are getting reaction to the UK government's decision to refuse the so-called Stormont break over labelling of chemicals coming in and out of Northern Ireland this time. The Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, simply said it just didn't meet the threshold for the Stormont break. That decision has been met with criticism from unionist parties, even the TUV going as far as to say the Stormont break is useless. The DUP's Gavin Robinson was on the programme too. He said the party did not oversell the mechanism when they returned to Stormont, and that the break has achieved something, he says, in the form of the UK government taking some form of action anyway, and by monitoring the situation. Lots of you had a lot to say on that. Today we also look back at Donald Trump's inauguration and the speech. We had a lot of executive orders. There was the Oath of Allegiance and there was Melania's hat. We had a lot to unpack there, but today we're reflecting on what impact Trump has had in just the first few hours of being back in office. And then that brought us on to a discussion around Trump's next move for the social media platform TikTok. He has said that he has a lot of rich people who are looking to buy it. But what does happen next to TikTok? You think it was just days ago that the previous administration banned TikTok in the United States due to its ownership by a Chinese company and concerns around security. So what has changed? As always, let us know what you would like to talk about here on The Nolan Show. It's nolan@bbc.co.uk. We're back tomorrow from 9 a.m. See you then. The Stephen Nolan Show! Hello, good morning. A very warm welcome on the 21st of January to The Nolan Show. It's Holly Hamilton here with you today and all week. What would you like to chat about today? What do you want to get off your chest? Maybe you were sat watching the inauguration of Donald Trump in Washington. Love your thoughts on that. Also today, we will be discussing a really important issue. Somebody got in touch with the show to tell us that they had noticed, once again, in their area, abandoned syringes and needles. Just left on the streets, left for children to find. Is this something that you have noticed yourself? And how do you have that conversation with a child? What needs to happen? 03030 80 55 55. Or maybe you would like to discuss our first topic today. Yeah, divisions over Northern Ireland's post-Brexit trading rules once again laid bare at Stormont. Secretary of State Hilary Benn has defended the government's decision not to trigger a safeguarding mechanism known as the Stormont break. Now, the break, of course, was designed to give Stormont a greater say before any amended EU rules could take effect in Northern Ireland.
I've looked carefully at all of the evidence that they submitted to me, but I formed the judgment that that test, a significant impact on everyday life in Northern Ireland, was not met. And in those circumstances, I have no option but to reject the notification. However, I have listened to the concerns the MLA has expressed. That's why we're going to have a consultation to take the necessary steps to ensure that there isn't a regulatory problem, so that people in Northern Ireland can continue to get the chemicals they want. And that is something the government is determined to do. And I think on reflection, when people move away from just focusing on the yes or no decision in relation to the break application and say, well, you know what, it looks as if we're going to get something here which deals with the problem we're worried about, I think most fine-minded people will say, fair enough.
Well, that was the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, speaking yesterday. Let's chat now to our political editor, Enda McLafferty. Good morning once again, Enda.
Good morning, Holly.
I think it's probably pretty important for anyone who isn't fully across this, just to set out once again what this is all about. So this is a bid to stop changes to EU rules, specifically on packaging and labelling of chemicals coming into Northern Ireland.
Yes, that's the specific case that the break was applied for by the unionist parties. They had the signatures, they got over 30 signatures at Stormont. That then, in a sense, requested the London government to put a break on this piece of amended EU legislation, which governs labelling and packaging and chemicals coming into Northern Ireland. The unionist parties argued that this was going to have a prolonged impact, was going to impact on people's day-to-day living, was going to cost over £1 billion, was going to have a negative impact on those companies who are going to have a different labelling system for Northern Ireland as opposed to the rest of the UK. So that essentially what it was about. They wanted this stopped. The break was the way they saw it to do that. But as we now know, the Secretary of State just didn't agree. And yesterday he laid out his reasons for rejecting this request from unionist parties to pull the break. And I have to say, it doesn't come as a great surprise because, as we suggested yesterday, if you watch the committee as they dealt with this issue, if you looked at the information that was coming across from London, there was a mindset in London which set out very clearly that they felt there's going to be a limited impact on Northern Ireland as a result of this piece of legislation. And the Secretary of State went along with that and yesterday talked about, for instance, there's already divergence, he said, in the labelling system between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. So therefore, he felt this wasn't going to be the massive issue that unionists were talking about. Also talked about most of these chemical companies already supply into the EU, so they're going to have to be compliant in terms of the labelling for the goods they're going to send across into the continent. Therefore, it wasn't going to be a big issue for Northern Ireland to be part of that equation as well. Talked as well about the fact that all these companies change their labels on average every 32 months. So there is a labelling change, if you like, which would allow those companies then to be able to make the adaptations that were required under this EU legislation. So as far as he was concerned, it didn't come close to reaching the threshold of affecting people's day-to-day lives in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, it's interesting then the reaction now from all walks of life within unionism. And we heard from DUP leader Gavin Robinson saying, you know, he was disappointed, and we'll hear from him in just a moment once again. You know, but so he said, yes, well, the government is now monitoring the situation. It's taking action because of this move, because of the Stormont break, ultimately. But overall, what's the reaction been like?
Yes, Gavin Robinson is claiming that in a sense of some sort of victory around this, even though that there was the overall rejection of what the unionist parties wanted to see happen. But Gavin Robinson, if you like, is making the most of this by basically saying, well, there is this now commitment by the government to monitor the movement of goods to ensure that there is no divergence. So Gavin Robinson, in a sense, is seeing something positive coming out of this. It's interesting to note in their responses, for instance, the TUV are very much attacking the mechanism, saying it's useless. They said all along it wasn't going to work, and here's evidence of that right now, whereas the DUP are more or less saying they're attacking the decision and not so much the mechanism, basically saying that they will reach for this mechanism again if they feel it's very much appropriate. I think what we did learn from yesterday and what's going to be very clear going forward is the government's commitment to ensure that there is no divergence. It very much points to the fact that that's going to be the way of the Labour government now, to ensure that there's very little divergence on companies across the UK when it comes to setting rules that are equivalent to what's happening within the EU, to make it easier for trade across the Irish Sea and across the British Channel, to ensure that there isn't any great divergence, to ensure there's no extra expense for companies. So you can see that's the road they're going down, and that's probably why they can make this commitment to unions in Northern Ireland, because they know that's the direction of travel that the government is now heading in. And that, of course, will help to ease and eliminate, perhaps through time, many of the checks which are currently required across the Irish Sea border.
And given what we know about the Stormont break, the idea is that it's supposed to be sort of a last resort. And given the way that this has gone and the result, as you say, perhaps wasn't that much of a surprise, was it a mistake for the DUP to try to initiate the break on this occasion?
Well, that's a question very much for Gavin Robinson. People on the outside looking in might say perhaps something else that was perhaps a little more airtight, that there was less wriggle room for the government and might have been more appropriate. The unionist parties, of course, would say no as far as they were concerned. This ticked all the boxes, still ticks all the boxes in their mind, and they feel that the break should have been applied in this case. But the government was able to point to the fact that there's already divergence taking place, point to the fact that companies are going to be supplying the EU anyway. So the government sought to dismantle the argument put forward by the unionist parties. I think the very fact as well that the Stormont Scrutiny Committee wasn't able to reach a decision on this very much took the view that it was open-minded in how this was going to impact on Northern Ireland. I suppose that in a way strengthened the government's hand as well, although the unionist parties would say that's more of a political move by some of those parties on the committee.
And thank you very much. That's our political editor, Enda McLafferty. And as I mentioned, we would hear from the DUP leader, Gavin Robinson. I spoke to him shortly before we came on air. And I started by asking him about his response to Hilary Benn claiming the current process is working.
I think it's clear from the letter that he accepts there's a problem with this regulation, and though he has decided that it doesn't meet the test, he is indicating that he is going to have to take steps to protect the UK internal market. And for unionists like me, that's exactly the concerns that we have, the concern in the specific instance around divergence, and the fact that the scale and the scope of this change impact £1 billion worth of trade to Northern Ireland is something that not only unionists like me, but every representative concerned. Democratic Scrutiny Committee took evidence on the issue. They recognised the significant impact it would have, having heard from the Chemicals Industry Authority. And so it was right to use this process. And it is right that the government are taking action, though disappointing that they haven't used the process in its entirety.
And he makes very clear, he says it very clearly, it does not meet the threshold. Is that not the end of the story?
Well, it's not the end of the story, because you've got the letter in front of you and it's 5 pages long, and he accepts that the issue is not only genuine, but there is an issue, and he is now launching steps and a consultation to make sure that there is no divergence. He is taking the steps necessary, and more importantly, he is now indicating action that government are prepared to take that they were not indicating to the Democratic Scrutiny Committee when this issue was before them in the autumn of last year. That's what government should do. Government should not wait for unionists to apply to use the storm and break. They should recognise the harm and the scale of the change that is proposed, recognise that it is out with not only the regulations in England and Wales and Scotland, but also UN international standards. The European Union are departing from a regime that is going to have an impact on the availability of these chemicals in Northern Ireland. He is now recognising that he is going to have to take steps to ensure there is no divergence. He is giving a commitment now that he could have given 3 months ago. That is a good thing, but as I say, it's disappointing that he hasn't proceeded with the whole process and hasn't shown the effectiveness of it.
There's been a lot of talk about what the overall plan of this government is around divergence, and it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but they seem to be trying to keep Great Britain in line with the EU to kind of take a UK-wide approach to this. You know, this bill that's going through the House of Lords at the minute, the Product Regulation and Metrology Bill, that seems to be about avoiding divergence with Northern Ireland, as far as I'm concerned, to try to keep Northern Ireland in line with the UK and therefore the EU.
That is right, and that is an appropriate step to take from their perspective. And also they talk on a whole range of other issues about the potential for an SPS agreement and alignment on those issues with the European Union. And all of that could be useful for us in Northern Ireland, but none of it gives elected representatives who are elected to Stormont to stand up for the people of Northern Ireland and create the right conditions for trade in Northern Ireland with the rest of our country and the United Kingdom. It doesn't assist them. It doesn't give them something to work with, though there is potential in the future. And I have to say, when it comes to this government and their plans, this yesterday's decision is just another disappointment in a long line of disappointments from a government that promised so much and is failing to deliver.
Well,
You have to go through winter fuel allowance.
Sorry to interrupt again, because I appreciate we're short on time. You obviously put faith in this mechanism. This was something that you helped to create, the Stormont break. Was it oversold?
No, it wasn't oversold. It is what it is. It cannot be used for trivial things. It cannot be used just because people have a visceral reaction to anything that comes from the European Union. That has always been known. Mm-hmm. I think the government have made a mistake on this occasion. I think it was very clear when you consider the dental amalgam issue that was considered when this government came into power, that the brake would have been used, and if the brake had have been pulled, it would have netted the same result. So the government, in recognising that, negotiated with the European Union and got an agreement that ensured there would be no divergence for Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom. So the ends justify the means. The break is there as a mechanism, and I can assure you there will be opportunities for its use in the future.
Well, I suppose
that will demonstrate its effectiveness.
But
there's two separate examples, both different processes, but both end with the same result of no divergence, which is what I want to ensure.
But anyone from the wider unionist community right now, they will be feeling like, well, it's another post-Brexit defeat here. We haven't got any further. The Stormont break was there to protect us.
Well, look, I'm disappointed that the government did not use the provisions that are before them. But that's different to say that it's a defeat, because, as I say, we are now seeing a government taking steps to ensure there is no divergence in a way that they didn't in the past on this issue. With the dental amalgam, you can show that had it have been pulled, and it would have been, save
but
for the
wasn't.
Fact that the resolution... save for the fact that a resolution was found in advance of it needing to be pulled, because it would have been effective, and the government focused their mind on making the right outcome.
But it wasn't effective. And Jim Allister, he's gone as far as saying that it's useless.
Second, Holly, you can't say it wasn't effective. What I'm indicating to you was, because they knew it would have been effective, they resolved the issue on dental amalgam at the start. And this process, the government have failed in their test to use the process to its full and complete end. But they have recognised there's an issue. They have recognised that the Assembly were right, in my view, to start the application process. And they are now taking steps to ensure there is no divergence. And for me, and for others within the unionist community, including Jim, we do not want to see divergence, and nor should we. We are in the United Kingdom. The recognition of the requirements that were put before us at the time of Brexit.
So why is Jim Allister calling the mechanism useless? Why is he calling it useless?
Well, Jim said it was useless from the very start. That was Jim's position on the Stormont break. And he and I both will not want to see divergence between Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom as a whole. Hilary Benn has recognised that this mechanism could, though he has decided not to proceed with the entirety of the Stormont break process. And he is now indicating in the letter that you've highlighted that he will take steps to ensure there is no divergence. So that is where we want to be. We do not want to be in a situation where there are barriers unnecessarily created between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom in a way that is going to harm trade, business, opportunities and access to opportunity for people in Northern Ireland.
And I suppose, and I'm sure you've been asked this question many times then, and it will be the question that a lot of listeners will be feeling, you know, the Stormont break, this was kind of the basis of the return of Stormont. This got things back up and going again. If this is failing, what power do you have? You know, you've said that the government has said that they are going to monitor the situation here. Is the collapse of the executive still your only card to play? And is that a possibility still?
Well, first of all, I didn't say that this was the only card to play. Second of all, Stormont was not that they got Stormont back. And running, I mean, that's just a falsehood. Stormont break was the Windsor Fair process.
You're breaking up there slightly, but it was part of the deal.
Insufficient. No, it was insufficient at the time of the Windsor market, Stormont up and running. I say this to you and to your listeners. When you listen to your programme or you engage with anybody on day-to-day issues across Northern Ireland, issues about waiting lists, provision of education, provision of special needs, provision of surgery, provision of good public services in Northern Ireland. Those are the issues that we need to deal with as politicians, as the imposition and the constitutionally improper arrangements that we have for Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom. We will continue on that path.
Gavin, your line is breaking up there slightly, so we may have to leave it there, unfortunately. But thank you very much for your time on that this morning. That was the DUP leader Gavin Robinson speaking to me a little bit earlier on. Listening to that is the TUV leader Jim Allister. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning. And Alliance MLA Owen Tennyson. Good morning to you, Owen.
Good morning, Holly.
Jim, I'll start with you first of all. I know your reaction to this decision. How do you interpret the Secretary of State's decision not to apply the break?
Well, I think he's giving the two fingers to unionism. I think he did that before Christmas by demanding and having a gerrymandered vote on the continuance of the protocol, denying the need for cross-community consent. Then he set up a review which gives a nationalist veto to any change. He wants to give money to Gerry Adams for his detention 50 years ago. And now when unionists say this is something which should be stopped, he refuses. So I think it's quite clear the path that the Secretary of State is on. But like, it's very important to set this in context. Mm-hmm. The context here is that this was one of 300 areas of law where Northern Ireland is not governed by laws we make or Westminster makes or the Assembly makes, but laws made by a foreign parliament. And we were given this mechanism, quite a demeaning mechanism in itself, which was called the Stormont break, that if you object to something, you can ask, please, sir, would you pull the break and stop that coming into effect? And that, of course, was sold to unionism by your last contributor, Gavin. Poor Gavin, you know, he went around the country a year ago telling us they'd cut the pipeline to EU law and the Stormont break was going to be part of that.
So do you not agree with Gavin? He says that there is a small victory here. James, apologies to interrupt you, but he is arguing that, yes, there is a small victory here because the government has said that they are going to monitor it. Although the specific test was not met because it was a significant one, we're going to make sure that we look at it and make sure there isn't going to be a problem. The UK government is insisting this will not be a problem.
Well, the UK government's answer to this is to try and realign the whole UK back into the EU on these regulations. Now, I think that will come as a disappointment and a surprise to people in GB who thought they had got Brexit. We never got Brexit. We were left behind as part of the EU single market and customs code. But his answer is the feeble answer of saying, oh, then we will realign the whole of GB, the whole of the UK with EU regulations. We will all become rule takers rather than taking back control. I don't think that's an answer for the United Kingdom, but that seems to be the answer that's pleasing Gavin. And of course, he's trying to excuse the fact that the break, which he made so much of, along with the other lie that the REC border was gone to justify coming back to Stormont, having made so much of it now, he has to make the best of its refusal. And, you know,
well, is,
no,
making the
no
is that not politics, Jim? Is that not politics going to make the best of a situation? You know, what is it that concerns you the most then in this? Because choices have to be made. That's how politics works.
Well,
is it more concerning being in line with the EU or divergence from the UK internal market?
No, what concerns me the most is the fundamental democratic situation that Northern Ireland has been left subject in 300 areas of law to foreign jurisdiction. Laws we don't make, laws is now clear we cannot change.
So being in line with the EU, that's what concerns you more?
That's the source of all this. So yes, I want to sort out the problem which causes this. And the problem which causes this is our subservience like a colony to EU. You know, we live in an age when anti-colonialism is supposed to be thriving. Well, the one place colonialism is thriving is in Northern Ireland, because we are subject to colonial control from EU, laws that they make that we can't change, and we're subject like patsies to those laws. That's the fundamental offence here. And here was supposedly a way out of that through the Stormont break, and it failed lamentably at the first attempt to pull it.
Let's bring in Alliance MLA Owen Tennyson, who's listening here. Owen, so Jim says this was two fingers up to unionism. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree, Holly. And you asked Jim what concerns him, and it's clear from listening to Jim that what concerns him is wrecking and blocking any kind of progress in Northern Ireland. He wants to wreck and block the political institutions. And he's tied himself in knots because on one hand he's talking about a democratic deficit and then he wants to pull down government here in Northern Ireland. So I think we can just dispose of Jim's position on many of these issues right up front. At the end of the day, if we want to put this in context, the reason why we are in this position is Brexit. When you come outside of the European Union, you create a border. When you have the kind of hard Brexit in particular that was pursued by Jim and others, that is the consequence of your actions. And it's now for the rest of us to try and manage that in the interest of everyone in Northern Ireland. I think the Secretary of State has made the right call on this particular issue, because it would be foolhardy for Northern Ireland, or for the UK for that matter, to chart its own path in respect of chemical safety standards. It makes much more sense for the UK to look at closer alignment with the EU to prevent divergence, because that is how you remove the border in the Irish Sea. I don't want to see any borders anywhere in these islands. That's why during the debate on Brexit, we argued for the closest possible relationship. We argued to be in the single market and the customs union UK-wide to prevent the situation that we're now in. We are focused on pragmatic solutions, taking advantage of the opportunities that dual market access presents, but also dealing with those practical challenges as they arise.
Well, in terms of those practical challenges, you are on the scrutiny committee. Do you have concerns? Just at the very crux of all this, it is these chemicals coming into Northern Ireland and the labelling. Are there concerns that will have an impact on the people of Northern Ireland?
Well, we need to be clear what we're talking about here, Holly, first of all. We're talking about the creation of new hazard classes to create transparency about potential health impacts of certain chemicals. That is a good thing. We're talking about issues around the font size and labelling for clarity and transparency. Some of these changes are very small and very technical. That is, in essence, a good thing and something that we should welcome for consumers. The potential issue is whereby you have a supplier which is based in GB, which is only supplying the UK market. That's quite a rare scenario. but they may not necessarily automatically comply with the EU regulation unless the UK government decides to align. So that's where you do encounter potential problems, small problems, but nonetheless significant in respect of supply. And so it's important that we do monitor those changes and the implementation, and that the UK government does consider that closer alignment to avoid any disruption, because we don't want to see disruption. I am a pragmatist. I am, of course, pro-European, but I also want to deal with each EU regulation on its merits and assess its impact in Northern Ireland. And where challenges do arise, I won't hesitate to articulate that. I articulated, for example, challenges around dental amalgam and the potential impact in Northern Ireland. So we need to take these on a case-by-case basis, not approach it as Jim and others have on an ideological basis. And I have to say, it was actually welcome to hear Gavin Robinson talk about the need for alignment between the UK and the EU to prevent that divergence. Because when Alliance was making that argument before we left the EU, that was rubbished by the DUP. And so hopefully some lessons are learned.
Are you seeing a change of stance here in the from the DUP?
Well, when we talked about a veterinary agreement and when we talked about dynamic alignment, that was dismissed by the DUP, when it mattered, when they held the balance of power at Westminster and could have brought some influence to the negotiations. They have pulled the brake, Holly, 8-9 years too late. The time to do that was before we left the European Union to make the argument for the closest possible relationship. They failed to do that. They were led by the nose by Jim and others, and they walked us to this position. And I hope now some lessons will be learned. It was also welcome to hear Gavin talk about the merits of the Assembly, because for 2 years, 2.5 years actually, they pulled down the Assembly and damaged the waiting list that Gavin talked about. They damaged...
Well, and on this occasion, he said, just to be clear, the DUP on this occasion, Gavin Robinson has said that that's not something that they're talking about doing, the collapse of the executive. And Jim, I'll put that to you, because I think on this occasion... What do you want to see happen next? Because, you know, it's been made very clear that there's going to be a consultation now to ensure that this isn't a problem, as I mentioned earlier. But does that go far enough for you? What do you want to happen next?
It's demonstrably is a problem.
How so?
Well, the professional body from the chemical industry said that this is a £1 billion industry into Northern Ireland, and these are a problem for it. But, you know, the fundamental, I'm going to return to the fundamental. You know, the colonialist that you've just had speaking for the last 5 minutes is very happy.
Now, just, we've got to be careful with our language here, Jim, in terms of, and I know the point that you're trying to make, but you have made it.
And I will make it.
What I want from you is the practicalities of this. I want to know why you have an issue with the chemicals coming in, because this is at the heart of all this. You believe that this is going to have a fundamental impact on the people of Northern Ireland. They're listening and they want to know how.
Well, I will deal with that. But I will also define what a colonialist is. A colonialist is someone who believes that a territory should be governed by a foreign territory and that they should meekly accept the laws made by a foreign parliament. That's what Mr. Tennyson is. That's what a colonialist is.
So again, this comes back to the EU Brexit debate.
That takes us to what's wrong with this issue. And what's wrong with it is that Northern Ireland has been denied to make its own decisions on these matters, its own laws on these matters.
This takes me back to the days of in-out Brexit, shake it all about. I mean, for the conversation we're having right now, a decision was made in that regards. These difficult decisions now have to be made to make, hopefully, the less impact on people of Northern Ireland as possible. What do you want to see happen now?
Well, you, Holly, may be content to accept colonialism in Northern Ireland and to say, suck it up, make the best of it. I'm not prepared to accept colonialism because I respect.
What do you want to see happen now?
I respect the people who elect me. They expect me and they expect people elected to the Assembly to be able to make the laws.
So in this issue of chemical labelling, do you feel strongly enough about this that you would like to see the collapse of Stormont?
Well, I believe that the DUP went back into Stormont on a false pretense. They told us the RDC border was gone, a lie. They told us they had cut the pipe of EU law, the Stormont break would be an aid in that. That turns out to be a lie. So when they went back in on false pretenses and give us a Stormont, which isn't working, by the way, which we've still got the huge waiting list and everything else, when they give us a Stormont that isn't working on false pretenses, then they need, and surrendered the only leverage they had to get change in the protocol, then they need to find reverse gear. And
so
yes,
what does reverse gear look like?
Looks like the DUP rediscovering their dignity and rediscovering the fact that the only leverage you have is not to operate Stormont so long as it is subject to colonial rule from the EU, and so long
so
as...
So how do they resolve that?
Well, they resolve that by resigning their seats from the executive and bringing this matter to a head and stopping the Secretary of State walking all over them and making fools of them. That's how they do it. They made the fools out of the people of Northern Ireland by saying they'd won all these battles, they got rid of the Irish Sea border, they got rid of the pipeline of EU law. They patently hadn't, so they need to retreat to that position, a face up to, man up to where they are, and say, look, if it matters to us, as it should as unionists, that we are being governed by a foreign jurisdiction, then we're not going to be the implementers of that. What we've had for the last year is the DUP and other unionist ministers implementing EU colonial rule. And if they can implement laws from Brussels, they could equally implement laws from Dublin. Is that where we're going?
Jim, Alistair, thank you very much. And Owen Tennyson as well. Lots of you getting in touch about our top story this morning. Reaction to Hilary Benn's decision not to implement the Stormont break. That's the safeguarding mechanism. The break, of course, was designed to give Stormont a greater say before any amended EU rules could take effect in Northern Ireland. This one specifically around the labelling of chemicals coming into Northern Ireland. Dan is on the line. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Holly. Holly, we have a situation here where Secretary of State said there's no impact from these labels on the consumers in Northern Ireland. The fact is, we have a government who doesn't understand the cost of living. We have pensioners losing their winter fuel allowance. But the thing is, and he says that because labels have already been introduced, they have not having any effect. But the thing is, those labels were not for sale in the EU. EU labels were supposed to be introduced in the UK as a whole, but the supermarkets there, they objected most strongly, and they said to do that, to introduce those labels in the UK would cost 250 million quid. And on top of the pay raises they had already given their employees in the supermarkets, to add that extra cost would impact on the rate of inflation. Now, does Hilary Benn not think if it costs £250 million to introduce labels in the rest of the UK, it doesn't cost proportionally the same amount of money to introduce labels in Northern Ireland? And not only that, but to cut the competition, which also drives up costs.
Is that so a concern for you, the cost over all of this?
Pardon?
Is this the cause of concern for you, the cost?
It's the cost, but it's also what Jim Astor says. You were talking there about an in-out Brexit, or in-out of Stormont. Well, we have every one of those EU regulations on medicine, right, on healthcare, on drugs. We have an in-out protocol policy because medicines have been removed from the protocol, but medical devices are still in the protocol. And now we have labels in the UK, not in the protocol, but in Northern Ireland. And can I just say to Owen Tennyson there about his ideology, an ideological Brexit? I've been in small business since I was 19 years of age. I depended on my small business from goods from the UK, and the innovative goods that were produced in the UK kept me up to date, gave me a competitive advantage in my small business. But as for ideological reasons, Michel Barnier himself, the man who negotiated the protocol, he said that France must draw back, was claimed back its sovereignty from the decisions of the European Court.
Dan, you're taking us way back here now. We're taking us to a place that I think we don't have time at 9:40 on a Tuesday to get into. But thank you very much for your call. Sammy's also on the line. Good morning, Sammy.
Hi, I get tired of the repeat that the Nolan Show does with Jim Allister, the first half hour repeating the same thing. And then amongst that, he has said this morning he wants to bring down Stormont over labels on bags of chemicals. That's incredible. And he's saying as well that Stormont doesn't have control of our destiny. The stuff that affects every person, every day in this country, housing and health, education and the economy, and they haven't made any decisions of note in the last 27 years. So there's one thing I probably agree with Jim Alastair on. Get rid of Stormont and bring in professional politicians with direct rule and influence from Dublin to make the hard decisions from our civil service, our health service, and deliver for the people, and stop squabbling about sectarian politics. And the BBC needs to wise up as a public broadcaster and stop platforming sectarian stories and get into health, housing, education and the economy. They affect everybody every day.
Well, that's I would like to think that those are issues that we address consistently on this programme. But Sammy, that, it's great, and I'm glad that we have given you a platform today to be able to give us your point of view. That is what we are here for. It's 03030 80 55 55. Let us know your thoughts. This is the platform for you. I'd like to bring in now John Tong, Professor of Politics at Liverpool University, of course. John, you've been listening intently throughout all of this morning. I think we need sort of to break down quite a little bit of this and what it all actually means. So let's go back to the very beginning in terms of the Stormont break. Was this the right use of the Stormont break as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that it shouldn't be called a Stormont break, because Stormont can't apply any break. All Stormont can do is request that the Secretary of State applies the break. So it's a misnomer, the very term Stormont break. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in terms of the decision itself, Hilary Benn, in his letter, said that procedurally the Unionist MLAs had acted correctly, that they had consulted widely, as is a requirement to try and apply what's called the Stormont break. There was consultation with business. He did note the low number of responses, but procedurally, so I suppose Unionist MLAs can take some heart from that they know what to do. What they did was act correctly. It was the substantive test that Hilary Benn said that had failed in terms of applying the Stormont break, that it was already a devolved matter, that there was already significant divergence in labelling, that firms anyway change their labels regularly on chemical products. The Chemical Industries Association said, look, you know, this is a matter that affects an awful lot of people. We all have household cleaning products in our homes. And that was a valid point. But the Secretary of State said, no, this does not have a significant impact upon everyday lives. That shows the Stormont break has a very, very, very high hurdle that you want to cross. Now, Gavin Robinson, as DUP leader, had a valid point in saying, look, where there's an issue that is going to affect people in their everyday lives en masse, many of us have mercury fillings in our teeth. He made the point about dental amalgam, that where you can see that coming down the track, the British government does act quickly to stop the Stormont break being pulled. But the weakness of the Stormont break was laid bare yesterday. There's going to be very few cases where it will be successfully applied, if at all. The question for Unionist MLAs now is, do they throw the kitchen sink at this and try and apply the break continually? Or are they going to be very selective and just pick a small number of cases on which they're going to try and apply the Stormont break? But it is a very, very weak mechanism. It's, frankly, you wonder about its validity. And I think the long-term process, and I think Jim Alistair made this point, I think, you know, UK-EU alignment would in many ways, ironically, suit the DUP, even as a Brexiteer party, because that solves the problem for the DUP. As long as the UK as a whole is aligned to the European Union, then, you know, these issues, these problems, which will continue to expose the DUP because they are the ones that signed up to this, you know, UK-EU alignment may be the way forward.
Because that's what's sort of interesting. This all kind of, at the end of all of the discussions and the conversations, it all kind of bottles down to what is more important for unionists. Is it being in line with the EU or not being in line with the EU, as it may be, or is it divergence from the UK internal market? It looks increasingly like that will be the choice that has to be made.
Well, UK-EU alignment is a betrayal in many ways of what was voted for in 2016. There's no question of that, albeit Northern Ireland didn't vote for Brexit. But you can make a case, going back to Jim Allister's colonial argument, if a majority of the Northern Ireland Assembly support that alignment, albeit it's not, you know, I take this point, it's not a majoritarian assembly, and if a majority of the Westminster Parliament, a sovereign parliament, backs greater UK-EU alignment, that in some ways addresses the colonial argument, because you've got two legislatures, we elect people to those legislatures. If they say greater UK-EU alignment is OK, then that partly addresses that argument. I think there's no doubt that's the direction Keir Starmer would like to go in, and I'm sure Hillary Benn would like to go in. Remember that there is a new trade deal with the EU in the offing, and I think that ever greater UK-EU convergence, that will, of course, will enrage those people who voted for Brexit, many of them in 2016. But that looks the likely direction of travel. It's not going to be about the mass application of the Stormont break. I mean, Hillary Benn will look for reasons not to apply the Stormont break. The last thing the UK government wants are serious rows in the joint committee with the EU in the run-up to the UK trying to get a new trade deal with the European Union. The issue of leverage, just dealing with the issue, the TUV point is the DUP surrendered all its leverage. If Gavin Robinson, as leader of the DUP, had said to Hillary Benn, if you don't pull the Stormont brake in this case, we're going to walk out of Stormont.
Yeah.
Let's imagine that world. Would Hillary Benn's decision have been any different yesterday? Most unlikely, because Hillary Benn has to follow the letter of the law. Now, again, you can say, well, the EU is setting those laws, but you have to the way that the law is framed makes it very difficult for the Secretary of State to apply that break. The question of leverage is, do you think you can get more by pulling out of Stormont? Did it work for the DUP for 2 years? No. If the DUP had stayed out for 4 years, would they have got more? Probably not. And that's the issue with the leverage argument. Don't get me wrong, the UK government would love to have likes devolved power sharing at Stormont.
Yeah.
It's not the be-all and end-all. The alternative is ad hoc direct rule, as we saw from 2017 to 2020 and as we saw from 2022 to 2024.
Talking about leverage there, is the DUP, is Gavin Robinson in danger then of every time he tries to apply the Stormont break, if it is rejected, something is becoming quite clear. And that is, as Norman Banger says, there are better brakes in my car.
Well, this is the difficulty for the DUP. If every time it's rejected, yes, it fuels a sense of grievance, but it also exposes, in many ways, the weakness of what the DUP signed up to. Now, Gavin Robinson, to some extent, distanced himself from what his predecessor as leader had signed up to by saying we should have engaged in, and I quote him, cautious realism, rather than overselling the deal that the DUP returned to Stormont on. And so every time the Secretary of State refuses to apply the Stormont break, which I think will be more often than not by some distance, then yeah, it's the DUP that looks embarrassed. You've got three different party positions within unions. We've had the TUV saying, basically break Stormont, not the Stormont break. You've had the DUP saying, well, we tried levering things by staying out of Stormont, but it didn't really work, although they don't admit that publicly. And the UUP have always said it was wrong to stay out of Stormont. There's no evidence that parties gain popularity by staying out of Stormont. No significant electoral evidence of that. So I'm not sure all the DUP can do is hope that the very existence of the Stormont break, and I accept Gavin Robinson's point on this, the very existence of the Stormont break will make the British government act in some cases. Going back to the dental amalgam point, frankly, every dentist in Northern Ireland was going to have to stop inserting mercury fillings at the start of this year under the original proposals. When representations were made to the British government, this would be disastrous for the Northern Ireland Dentistry Association. Everything was basically abandoned. Northern Ireland's dentists don't have to ban such products, in the insertion of such products, until 2034 now. They've got 9 years' grace to do that.
Now,
you can argue that without the Stormont break, you could make a case, at least, without the Stormont break, that wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
So, you can argue the mere existence of the Stormont break does produce some action, but it's stretching a point.
I want to bring in former special advisor to the Labour Party, Kevin Marr. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Holly.
I'm interested in your take on this then. From what Hillary Benn has said, and he's quite clear in that letter that, the bar, I think, is quite high for the Stormont break to be applied. So the question is, what power does the Stormont break have, if any?
Well, I think we're just back, the politics of this, I think, are extraordinary. We're back with the Unionist parties kind of determined to kind of unprove Albert Einstein's famous theory of that if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, that you'll get a different result each time. His theory of madness. The fact is here, what's happened in the last 5 years is the DUP and unionism has experienced three different kinds of British government. It's been led up the garden path by what I refer to as the Bronze Age, the Brit romantic nationalists, the Boris Johnsons, these kinds of characters, we're going to suck it to the EU. Northern Ireland's part of the UK. We're not going to do, and we're not going to treat it anywhere in any way differently. And of course, he delivers the Northern Ireland Protocol. We've then had Rishi Sunak, a kind of Tory moderate, that's tried to kind of work with the grain of the European Union. He's not got very far, and he lands unionists with the Windsor framework. And then along comes Keir Starmer with his whacking great Labour majority, who's given them a dose of reality. I mean, I think as Professor Tong pointed out a minute ago, there is no way this Labour government, with all the problems it's got in its bulging in-tray, is going to go around picking fights with the European Union on the basis of trying to make unionist politicians feel good about the chemical classification, labelling and packaging regulation. I mean, you know, this is not a hill to die on in terms of a political cause. And I think it's foolish for the unionist parties to kind of pick very poor ground to make a fight with, given Westminster is pretty clear. Three different kinds of government, they've all landed unionists with the same problem, the same dilemma. Northern Ireland, because of Brexit, is going to be treated differently than the rest of the UK.
I think that's probably the concern for some unionists, certainly, that, you know, the relationship with their place within the United Kingdom is playing second fiddle to the United Kingdom's relationship with the European Union.
What three consecutive British governments of very different political flavours have done is to say that the British interest and the interest of the UK are now subtly different things. That the British interest, the real economy, England, Scotland, Wales, what it needs is a kind of a rapport going forward post-Brexit with the European Union, and Northern Ireland is not going to be allowed to upend any of that. So, you know, with talk of collapsing Stormont, talk of colonialism, I mean, it's just hot air. It's absolute hot air. And it's very clear from Hilary Benn's letter that the government is going to try and do whatever it can with a very limited scope that it's got with the European Union to try and smooth off rough edges. It's perfectly prepared to do that. But what it's not prepared to do is every single, on every single issue that comes along, placate unionist opinion. And it's contingent on the leadership within unionism to recognise this, to get to be able to read the room, smell the coffee, whatever metaphor you want to use, and pick its battles very sparingly, and try and work constructively, because this kind of student union politics we've heard from Jim Allister 20 minutes ago leads absolutely nowhere.
Well, that's interesting. We have had reaction from all the unionist parties on this, of course, including the UUP. And I spoke to the UUP, Steve Aitken, earlier this morning. And I did ask him if he was actually surprised by the government's decision.
Yes, I was surprised. And the reason I was surprised, because of all the rules and regulations that have been coming down the stream, this one is a very clear example of the cumulative effect of changes that are making divergence. And there are going to be real significant impacts in Northern Ireland. And when the Secretary of State, in his letter, and it's quite an extensive letter, points out the fact that particularly with the Windsor Framework Democratic Scrutiny Committee, which, as I have been at pains to say many times, even though I sit on that committee, doesn't do much scrutiny, we realised that there were significant changes and there was going to be significant implications in Northern Ireland. The fact that the Secretary of State has dismissed this, I think, is of concern.
Has he dismissed it? Because he says, as you say, it's an extensive letter. He says that ultimately it didn't meet the threshold. And if it doesn't meet the threshold, he can't implement the break.
Well, one of the things we're going to have to do, and I think people should start looking at very closely, is the workings or the non-workings of the Windsor Framework Democratic Scrutiny Committee and the absolute tons of legislation and the rest that comes before us and what we're trying to look at. And actually, the information that we have in front of us is it did meet the criteria. And I found it quite strange today, believe it or not, the United Kingdom government and the EU are in The Hague, at the Court of Arbitration, talking about sand eels on the Dogger Bank. And that seems to have a higher priority than what's going on in Northern Ireland and the impact it's going to be on Northern Ireland businesses. And I think the Secretary of State had an opportunity to demonstrate that the safeguards actually do work. And that's what he should have done. So we'll be talking to the Secretary of State. We'll be talking to various other sort of stakeholders around this issue as well.
Where do you see this all going? Because sorry to interrupt you, Steve, but just sort of reading between the lines of this, it sort of looks like the way that Hilary Benn has worded this letter and how he's addressed it and the way the government, you know, within the product regulation and metrology bill that's making its way through the House of Lords, a lot of the guidance seems to be trying to avoid divergence. In fact, anything that sort of talks about any issues, it's trying to kind of keep it in line with the EU. And trying to make a more UK-wide approach to include Northern Ireland. Ultimately, of course, there are critics of that and of that bill. Ultimately, it can use Northern Ireland to keep the whole country in line with the European Union. But as far as you're concerned, that prevents divergence within the UK internal market.
But again, and I keep on emphasising this fact, nobody's looking at the cumulative effect of all these rules and regulations and the divergence that is already occurring. Look, I was never a Brexiteer. And yeah. I'd be one of the people who would say I want to see as close alignment as possible to prevent these things.
And do you not think that's being done?
Even more, that we're in a situation right now, Holly, that this divergence is continuing day in, day out, and despite what the Secretary of State is saying, that is not what is actually happening. And I think this is something that we're going to have to wake up to the fact is that this is going to have a real significant impact on everyday life in Northern Ireland. It already is having a significant impact. And the Secretary of State has missed an opportunity here.
When we heard from the TUV leader, Jim Allister, he's described it as a moment of truth for the DUP here. How did the UP consider this? Is it a moment of truth? What kind of response would you like to see now?
Look, the Ulster Unionist Party, we thought long and hard before signing this, and I did a lot of briefing to our team, and I've been briefing the Ulster Unionist Party for months on the changes and the various things that are coming through. And this isn't the only thing. I mean, I'm surprised that the Stormont break hadn't been pulled on several other issues. And anybody who's been watching the Windsor Framework Democratic Scrutiny Committee, and you know, it'll be a bit of a turgid watch for those who are doing. But there are more than one or two occasions when the break should have been pulled. And it hasn't been. And I think one of the things we're going to have to do is there's going to have to be a fundamental review of the safeguards, because quite frankly, the two safeguards that are supposed to be there are the Windsor Framework Democratic Scrutiny Committee, which isn't working, and the Stormont break, which the Secretary of State has just shown, despite the fact that there are real concerns about what was happening, he's unwilling to pull.
Oh, so, what power do you think that what power exists to prevent this then from continuing? Are you saying that this is worth the collapse of Stormont again?
No, look, I'm not in the TUV, I'm not in the DUP. I've been arguing for years now about getting a good relationship between the UK and the EU to make sure we don't get in these positions. And our party has been vehemently opposed to the Irish Sea border and everything that's been ongoing to do with the west of it. This is not about collapsing Stormont. This should be about making sure that the people of Northern Ireland get the best deal possible. We're not in the best of both worlds. We're in the worst of both worlds.
That was the UP's Steve Aiken speaking to me a little earlier this morning. Let's finish up with John Tong here to react to that. I mean, that's an interesting question, that. Steve saying that we are not in the best of both worlds. Far from it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think he's right. There's this guff about best of both worlds. Basically, Northern Ireland is in limbo land. In terms of where we go from here, we'll see more attempts to pull the Stormont break. We'll see the Secretary of State saying he's going to explicitly consult and shoring up Northern Ireland's place in the UK internal market. Goodness knows what that means. He didn't clarify at all. And, of course, we've got the ongoing review by Lord Paul Murphy of Northern Ireland's trading arrangements. I don't expect that to lead anywhere in particular.
John Tong, thank you as always for your expertise on that. Thank you as well to former special advisor to the Labour Party, Kevin Maher, and to all the guests on that this morning. We will be taking your calls on this after 10 o'clock. We will be talking now about the United States' latest president, second time round, Donald Trump. Yes, he's been sworn in as the 47th US president. And in his inaugural address, he said the golden age of America begins right now, adding that he will be a peacemaker and a unifier. He's already set to work signing a swathe of executive orders. But here are the highlights from his State of the Union speech.
All illegal entry will immediately be halted, and we will begin the process of returning millions and millions of criminal aliens back to the places from which they came. I'm pleased to say that as of yesterday, one day before I assumed office, the hostages in the Middle East are coming back home to their families. Instead of taxing our citizens to enrich other countries, we will tariff and tax foreign countries to enrich our citizens. We will pursue our manifest destiny into the stars, launching American astronauts to plant the stars and stripes on the planet Mars. A short time from now, we are going to be changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Today, I will also declare a national energy emergency. We will drill, baby, drill.
Well, yes, we didn't want to play it in all its glory because it was quite long. I don't think I worked out how long it was in the end. But yes, he was in a very sort of, I think fair to say, a reflective mood because he was using his speech to highlight what can only be described as rocky road back into the White House.
Over the past 8 years, I have been tested and challenged more than any president in our 250-year history. And I've learned a lot along the way. The journey to reclaim our republic has not been an easy one, that I can tell you. Those who wish to stop our cause have tried to take my freedom and indeed to take my life. Just a few months ago in a beautiful Pennsylvania field, an assassin's bullet ripped through my ear. But I felt then and believe even more so now that my life was saved for a reason. I was saved by God to make America great again.
Now, there was a bit of controversy when the world's richest man and one of President Trump's biggest backers, Elon Musk, was talking to the crowd. And at one point, and you can see this for yourself, he sort of places his right hand over his heart and then thrusts the same arm straight ahead of him. And critics have said it kind of looked like a Nazi salute. So here's the moment that it happened.
There are elections that they come and go. Some elections are important, some are not. But this one really mattered. And I just want to say thank you for making it happen. Thank you. My heart goes out to you. It is thanks to you that the future of civilization is assured.
So, there was an awful lot that happened, a lot to unpack here in what was a relatively short space of time. Watching and listening was Tom Rivers, the US journalist. Good morning once again, Tom.
Good morning,
Holly. Good morning. Also on the line, we've got Scott Lucas, Professor of American Politics at the University College Dublin and political commentator. Good morning, Scott.
Very good morning to you, Holly.
Lovely to have you both on. Tom, I'm going to start with you. We were chatting yesterday, of course. What did you make then overall of the speech, the announcements? What has come first?
Well, I guess you have to look at the fact that, most of the time a president comes in and you're generally looking at two terms. So you can kind of ease yourself in. This time it's very, very different. And he's learned his lessons over his first run in 2016. He's got a team that I guess is going to be more on a par with his thinking, his agenda, and he's hit the ground running. And, to paraphrase what Elon Musk had said in that soundbite, basically the fact that, we have changing of administration. Sometimes they're important. Sometimes they're not quite as important. This is a dramatic, dramatic sea change, a big, big change. The dissatisfaction felt in America over the past 4 years, deep-seated satisfaction, and the decline of many, many workers in America. This is a big, big change. You think of things that he kind of put his pen to yesterday. This would be normally a week-long, if you will, topic for the media. Wow. Says he wants to get out of WHO, get out of the Paris Climate Accords. I covered that 8 years ago. Big, big things. Again, a national emergency at the southern border. He is hitting the ground running. He's running like he's got 4 years, as I say, not 8 years. The world is changing. Out the back door is the pro-woke globalist mentality. 4,000 people meeting in Davos right now are going to be very, very nervous indeed.
Scott, what did you make listening to it? I mean, it was sort of a mix of reflections, some sharp jabs, and ultimately, of course, you know, and you would expect that from Donald Trump, a promise of better things to come. What was your takeaway?
This was a me speech, because it wasn't about America's golden age, but about Trump complaining about the barbarism. In other words, holding him politically accountable, as you played in your clip, complaining about the attempts as a convicted felon to hold him legally accountable, and then saying that God had saved him so he could make America great again. But I think it's important to get to the specifics of the actions of that speech. So today, millions of Americans, or millions of people in America, 12 to 13 million, are at risk of deportation and will be fearful of that because Trump has made them the enemies within. Already, those people who have legally applied for asylum in the United States or for migration in the United States, 30,000 are stranded at the Mexican border because the application, the app that they use, was just cut off immediately. The refugee resettlement program has been suspended, leaving thousands of people in limbo as they try to get into the United States and flee repression. Asylum seeking, Trump is trying to make it illegal. Climate change, you have America pulling out of any type of international approach to climate change. You have unrestricted, at the same time, use of fossil fuels. You have pulling out of international efforts to provide decent health care, such as the World Health Organization. Trump has said, effectively tried to ban an entire section of Americans, those people whose gender identity is transgender, denying them their rights, their ability to serve in the military. He has actually put a ban on diversity, inclusion, and equity, which further threatens rights and responsibilities. So, you know, cut through the rhetoric. What you have is a man who is not making this a golden age for Americans. He's making it us, the people who he feels support them, versus them. And that will include an effort to break the American system, because one of the executive orders last night cleared the way to fire thousands of civil servants, thousands of military personnel, simply because Donald Trump will call them, misusing this term, as we've heard it misused a couple of minutes ago, as calling them woke.
Yeah, but Tom, what do you make of that? And it's something we chatted about yesterday, the idea that, you know, there will be so many of these people who will be out of a job today, effectively. And the other side of that, and he has got a bit of criticism for this, is the pardoning of those in connection with the Capitol riots on the 6th of January. That seems to be a priority for him. Those people will be released within hours, if not already.
Very, very much so. And it is not drip, drip, drip. He's cutting to the chase, saying nearly 1,600 you're being pardoned right here, right now. If you don't like it, you can lump it. If you're a snowflake, that's tough. Take, you know, it's bad bounce for you. If you're crying in your beer right now, remember the fact that of the seven battleground states, the score was 7-0. The mood in America is very, very different than some of the, if you will, proponents of the agenda of the Biden administration. And look what Biden did yesterday. 10 minutes before leaving the White House, he pardoned five members of his own family. A few hours before that, he pardoned the members of the J6 Select Committee. Very, very different approach to governing America. And Americans are in for one hell of a ride, but a very, very different one than we've seen over the past 4 years.
And you mentioned it, and Scott, I'd love your take on this, the idea that Trump can just withdraw simply from the World Health Organization and the Paris Agreement. Can he do that? And why might that be hugely significant?
May I make an appeal to discuss this without using Trump's insult terms like snowflake and globalist, and then say that the reason why he can pull the America out of international cooperations is it's part of his executive power. You, of course, have congressional powers. You have judicial powers. But as long as Donald Trump does something which does not need congressional authorization or does not break a treaty, then he is able to do so. You know, and that includes participation in the World Health Organization, which is not covered by a treaty, from international climate change organizations and from other international organizations, which basically are there for rights and welfare of people, both in America and abroad.
There were a lot of other takeaways yesterday, and like I say, just so much to get through. And it's over what I find interesting, and I think it was
Hugh Scott, who said, you know, that this will be giving the papers stories for days. He's on the front page of every single front page across the United World, various different headlines. Unleashed, I'm back, baby, back in power. What have you made of the world's response to this? Because I do think, Tom, that it does feel different. You know, I mentioned on the way into this that his speech was slightly longer. It felt slightly more, I don't know if aggressive is the right word, but as you say, because he has only one term to do it, he has come out swinging this time.
Well, very, very different indeed. I mean, years ago, 40 years ago, I used to cover the NATO defense ministers, foreign ministers, and summits in NATO headquarters in Brussels. And basically, whatever America says in NATO is basically the NATO policy. So whatever he says will reverberate, will echo in the halls in Brussels, not only at NATO, but certainly at the EU. Look at relations between the UK. The relationship has always, by definition, been special. This time, though, you've got individuals saying the Labour government that have been throwing aspersions his way for the past few years. On a personal level, it's going to be very, very touchy and tetchy. It's going to be a very, very different kind of relationship. We're not going to be looking at Reagan and Thatcher this time around. It's going to be more held at a distance. Does that mean there's going to be tariffs? Will there be a special trade deal? Who knows? Watch your space.
Watch this space indeed. Tom Rivers, thank you very much. And to Scott Lucas as well. Really interesting to get their insight on this. And as I say, I don't think there'll be a lot more to unpack over the days to come. And one of the issues that has emerged over the last day, or perhaps even the last few days, is the issue of TikTok. Now, Trump had signed an executive order granting TikTok, the social media site, a 75-day extension to comply with a law that requires a sale or ban of the platform. So on Saturday evening, the Chinese-owned app stopped working for American users after a law banning it on national security grounds came into effect. Now, the Biden administration had argued that TikTok could be used by China as a tool for spying and political manipulation. Well, speaking to reporters at the White House, President Trump said the executive order granted him the authority to determine the fate of the video sharing app.
I may not do the deal, or I may do the deal. TikTok is worthless if I don't approve it. It has to close. I learned that from the people that own it. If I don't do the deal, it's worthless, worth nothing. If I do the deal, it's worth maybe $1 trillion, a trillion. So if I do the deal I'm talking about doing it for the United States. If I do the deal for the United States, then I think we should get half. The U.S. should be entitled to get half of TikTok. And congratulations, TikTok has a good partner. And that would be worth, you know, it could be $500 billion or something. It's crazy. The numbers are crazy. But it's worthless if the president doesn't sign, then it's worthless. If the president does sign, it's worth maybe $1 trillion. So I think, like a joint venture, I think we would have a joint venture with the people from TikTok.
So what exactly does this mean for those using the platform in the United States? And could other countries look to follow if America does ban it? I'm joined now by former senior military intelligence officer Philip Ingram. Good morning to you, Philip.
Good morning.
And also on the line, I have Jessica Nevenin from Index on Censorship. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
Now, Philip, I'll start with you because I think a lot of people are unclear on exactly what has happened here, why it was banned, and what the concerns are.
It was banned on national security lines because TikTok is owned by the Chinese company ByteDance. The Chinese national intelligence law requires all Chinese companies to cooperate with them if they're asked. And ByteDance has certainly been asked to do that. TikTok does two things. It's a fantastic video sharing platform that has gone viral and provides a social media output. But the second thing it does is it gathers huge amounts of data, and it gathers that data from the devices that are being used to host TikTok, to stream from. So your phone, your tablet, and anything else. And it gathers everything that's on that device. So whether you think it's encrypted, whether it's stuff that you think TikTok should have or shouldn't have, it takes the lot and holds it in big servers inside China. And Donald Trump's approach is purely one of economics, because he wants to try and get a fraction of the profits that are being made on the surface, the video sharing bit. The concerns are all about the data, and there is no legal oversight in what happens to people's individual data. So privacy laws don't count when it comes to data gathered by TikTok.
So just to be clear, because I think a lot of people will assume that TikTok is just people kind of doing dance videos and cat videos and all the rest of it. And it's bigger than that, because we are putting a lot of information on there. We're putting all our data, everything about us. And that's the concern here. So should it be banned?
It's more than just the data that you're putting on TikTok. It's that everything that you've got on your phone or on your tablet, your personal photographs, your personal WhatsApp exchanges, your personal videos, even if you've got them in encrypted folders, your access to all of the data that you hold on your device, everything is being hoovered up. The Chinese intelligence organizations are massive vacuum cleaners for data. They're holding them in huge servers inside China, waiting for the development, and it's very close, within months or a year, of their quantum computing capability to analyze that data. And then the manipulation of that data can allow them to influence the way people get other information pushed to them. And that can influence the way people vote, the way people think, and everything else. There's some very, very comprehensive research behind this.
Jessica, it feels like TikTok is this huge beast. You know, it's the genie out of the bottle, because, you know, there's a situation there at the weekend where, and I'll be honest, when I saw the headline, I initially assumed you won't be able to stop TikTok. Somebody will always bring it back.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I know that I think that Philip is absolutely right. I mean, data is effectively the new oil, and I think people often think, you know, who cares? It's just dancing videos. What would China do with my data anyway? But I think that crucially misunderstands the value of this collective data, and especially to a foreign, possibly hostile state. But banning TikTok outright is just a blunt and crude, you know, attempt to fix a problem that isn't, it's not really doing it in the right way. Because firstly, I mean, the US government has not presented any evidence of an immediate harm caused by TikTok, just suggests there's a potential future harm, which I think we agree that there certainly is. But that means that it's not urgent to ban it right now, and there could have been potentially other intermediate steps the US government could consider or could have considered before banning the whole platform that is used by a third of Americans. So, for example, there's no federal data protection law in the US, and the US is the only country in the G20 not to have a comprehensive privacy law. And we know that bans as well, given that they're a blunt instrument, can end up having unforeseen consequences. For example, more than 700,000 US-based users have already downloaded RedNote, which is another Chinese-owned app. So that raises, you know, many of the same concerns as TikTok. You know, are they going to have to ban RedNote now as well? It ends up just seeming like whack-a-mole, and that's not a good way to approach legislation.
Yeah, Philip, that's a really interesting point, because, again, that's what I would assume would happen, and we see it all the time with social media. If people aren't getting what they need from one site, they all very quickly, en masse, move to another one.
It is, and the whack-a-mole analogy is 100% right. And, you know, this is the trouble with apps that are coming from countries which have got no legal oversight, there's no legislative oversight, and there's no ability for free press to then analyse things. You know, and people then say, yes, but surely Facebook and Twitter and everything else is gathering all the same information. Yes, it is, but in the countries that's gathering the information, there tend to be privacy laws. There isn't a federal one in the United States. There are a lot of state laws. You then have other legal oversight that can be brought into what's been what data has been collected and how that data has been used. And if that doesn't work, you've then got the free press that take it apart. And that happened with the viral game Pokemon Go when it first came out, because it gathered everything. The press found out about it, and Google, who owned it, were forced to back down and make sure that they had closed all the little ports that they had that were gathering everyone's photographs, everyone's texts, everyone's emails, everyone's contacts. TikTok has got none of that oversight. That's the trouble.
What do you make, Jessica, then, of Donald Trump, you know, giving that executive order, granting him the authority to determine the fate of TikTok in the United States? It does feel like a lot of power.
Yeah, it seems like in a way he's trying to buy time a little bit. That, you know, I think many people ask, wouldn't a sale, if a sale were to happen, wouldn't it have happened by now? They had time to at least get talks started, but that hasn't happened. So now that Trump is in the driving seat, he seems keen to keep TikTok, not least because, in his own words, he's a big star on the platform. And now he's been widely credited with it being reinstated as well. And we know that Trump likes to position himself as something of a broker. So is he going to try to use his position to try to broker a deal? A lot of the tech executives, including TikTok CEO, were at the inauguration just yesterday. And Xi Jinping was also invited to the inauguration, although his deputy attended instead. And we know that the TikTok algorithm, which makes the platform what it is, cannot be sold without the permission of the Chinese government. So they will have to get the Chinese government involved, and maybe, you know, bringing some of these stakeholders together could be Trump's start of an effort to try to get it sold. Certainly, that's one option that could be approached, if not, you know, looking to turn over the legislation altogether. But given that the legislation passed, I think it was 362 votes to 65, it seems unlikely that that's the path that they will go down. But, you know, Trump was the one to have brought in the executive order banning TikTok in 2020 in the first place, which was then overturned by a Pennsylvania court. So, you know, it's so hard to know with Trump. There's a lot of you know, ups and downs to this. So it remains to be seen what could happen.
Philip, who buying TikTok would make you feel secure? Because the comments from Donald Trump, he says, I tell you what, every rich person has called me about TikTok. And I imagine because everyone realises the value, it's very powerful as well as actually monetary value. Is there anyone who could own TikTok that would make you think, yeah, we're safe?
Not if its parent company remains ByteDance or keeps any company that is connected into China, because Article 7 of the Chinese National Intelligence Law requires them to cooperate. And it's not the surface algorithms that are sharing the videos that are so many people have got their businesses based on and everything else. It's what's happening to the data underneath. And that is still being sucked away. Donald Trump's executive order is all about trying to do a deal. We heard him talking about, you know, its value, $1 trillion, and he could get you know, half of that for the United States. He's thinking business, but he's also using this as a way of sending a threat to China to say, you know, I can deal with big companies like TikTok, like ByteDance, and threaten you from a business perspective. So watch out. This is the beginning of you know, Trump 2.0 coming to get you.
And Jessica, what concerns you then? Because obviously we're watching this all play out in the United States effectively, and that's where the remit of a ban would remain unless other countries followed suit. Is that something that you might expect? What attitude do other countries take towards TikTok and social media?
I think, I mean, in the EU, we've seen much more of a legislative approach. It's bringing in and you know, finding platforms. And obviously, there's been a lot of concern around TikTok's interference in elections, including most recently in Romania. So I think there remains a close watch on TikTok. But I don't believe that, for now at least, it doesn't seem likely that other countries will follow suit. And certainly, we hope that's the case. We believe that there's other ways to rein in the platforms rather than outright banning them.
It is a really interesting discussion. And again, I don't think this will be the end of it. And I imagine at some point it will be a conversation we'll be having within the remit of the UK and the government here, and lots of decisions that have to be made around social media in general. Jessica Nivanin, thank you very much for joining us from Index on Censorship. And a former senior military intelligence officer, Philip Ingram, thanks for your time on that. Thank you as well to all our guests this morning. And thank you for all of your calls and your texts. I appreciate we didn't have time in the end to get to our topic on abandoned syringes and needles. That's something that we do plan to pick up again tomorrow, so an opportunity for you to have your say. And I'm really interested to see what you think about the current situation in Northern Ireland. Nolan@bbc.co.uk. We'll be back tomorrow from 9 o'clock. Connor's next.
In the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.